Thank you, Vice-Chancellor. My head of school said at a recent meeting, Sue only comes to meetings if the TV cameras are on these days. So, but it is a great pleasure to be here this evening to be able to talk to you about the 300 million year war. And as the name implies, this is a battle that's been going on a very long time. And it's a battle between plants and the animals, herbivores, that try and eat them. And you might think that this is a war that really shouldn't last very long at all. Plants are surely at a disadvantage. They can't see or hear, and they certainly can't run away. But actually, plants seem to be winning the war. They're the oldest living organisms on the planet. This is a bristlecone pine, not looking particularly flush with youth, but then it is 4,500 years old, so it's got an excuse. They're the biggest living organisms. Sequoias can be 90 metres tall and weigh 6,000 tonnes, so the weight of 15 blue whales. So plants actually dominate the planet. And there's around 1,000 times more plant biomass than animal biomass. But interestingly, it's on land that plants achieve their greatest dominance. So in land systems like tropical forests, less than a fifth of the available plant biomass is eaten by animals. And that's a bit of a puzzle to ecologists, because in aquatic systems, it's very different. Most of the plant biomass is consumed. So, our terrestrial world is green, our aquatic world is blue. It was worth coming tonight, wasn't it, to hear that? But why are land plants so successful? Well, one reason is that plants are nowhere near as defenceless as they look. They might not be able to run away, but they certainly know how to fight. And chemical warfare was invented by plants. There are at least 100,000 different kinds of chemical weapons that plants produce. And those are just the ones we know about, of course. Every time we look, we find more. So plants are little mini chemical weapons factories, and they make all sorts of poisons. And when we eat plants, we're just the same as other animals. We consume a lot of these poisons. So on a typical day, you're going to eat around 2 grams of plant toxins. And in your lifetime, you'll eat about 10,000 different sorts. So you're probably thinking, is nothing on the supermarket shelf safe? But actually, we're quite good at dealing with these toxins. And to give you an example, in cabbage, there are around 49 different kinds of poisons, which does, of course, explain why cabbage tastes quite as lovely as it does. Now, some of these toxins, many of them do not do us any harm. They're directed against other organisms like insects, but some of them are absolutely deadly. And some of you may have seen in the news that this woman decided that plants would be a good way to deal with her former lover and his new fiancé. And the so-called curry murder involved her poisoning those poor people with this plant, aconite, sometimes known as wolf's bane or monk's hood. And it contains this chemical. I'm going to make you draw it out later, see if you can remember its structure. And these chemicals, with all these different ring structures in, are alkaloids. And when you see those sorts of chemicals, it's usually a dangerous sign, because alkaloids are often very toxic. This particular one, as well as seeing off this woman's lover, is used for hunting and also for warfare. So alkaloids are very, very poisonous. But of course, some of these poisons are very, very useful. And I'm indebted to Henry Oakley for sending me this lovely guide to the medicinal garden that the Vice-Chancellor referred to. And in the garden, there are lots of plants that are useful to us. And we shouldn't forget, as the Vice-Chancellor was saying, that a lot of our medicines are originally from plants. And in fact, 8 out of 10 of our most important medicines are plant-derived, even now. And the intro to this book is lovely. It says, "This book is for interest, and none of the plants shown within it should be eaten, drunk, or smoked, except a few, such as Camellia sinensis, which makes a perfectly legal cup of tea." So I won't be showing it to our students. But here are a few useful compounds that we still use. This is morphine. From poppies, of course, and a closely related chemical, heroin, was made by making a small adjustment to one of these side chains, and the people creating heroin were trying to find a chemical that was less addictive than morphine. Sadly, they found about the one thing that's more addictive than morphine. But it just shows you that small changes to these chemical structures make a big difference to their impact, and that's something that plants exploit. Here's another very useful compound. This is atropine from deadly nightshade, and I believe there's some of that growing in the garden, but please don't try any. As it says in this lovely book, all parts are poisonous, even though the berries look very enticing, so don't be tempted. Although apparently in years gone by, it used to be used to introduce unconsciousness before operations. So that is a bit of a lottery. Cure could be worse than... But there we go. And here are some of our favourite plant weapons. This is caffeine, a saviour of students with deadlines coming up. This is aspirin. Another very useful compound. And this is one of the most poisonous plants in the world. In fact, in some ways, you could consider it the most poisonous plants in the world because it's tobacco. And one person dies every 8 seconds from smoking-related diseases, and nicotine is a highly addictive substance as well as very toxic. And it's worth remembering that these chemicals were, of course, produced by plants in order to kill things. So although we like a lot of these chemicals and found them useful, they are, by and large, extremely poisonous. And caffeine is very toxic to insects. And a relatively small dose is lethal to caterpillars. And an even smaller dose makes beetles sterile. Fortunately, humans are a little bit more robust in the face of caffeine than that. But this plant is the deadliest of all, castor oil plant. Now, castor oil sounds lovely. What could be wrong with castor oil? And indeed, from the seeds, we get this lovely health-giving castor oil substance, but we also, from the seeds, get one of the most toxic chemicals in the world. And the seeds contain a compound called ricin, and ricin is 500 times more poisonous than cobra venom and 1,000 times more poisonous than cyanide. So the lethal dose is only around a microgram per kilo of body weight. So you can sit there and work out how much would kill you if you inhaled it. So it's very, very poisonous. And this is another plant poison that's been used to kill people. I seem to be a bit obsessed with murder at the moment, but this ricin was used in the so-called umbrella killings. And this was in 1978, when a Bulgarian dissident was walking along Waterloo Bridge, as you do, and somebody stabbed him in the leg with an umbrella. And they injected, he thought that was rather odd, particularly when they ran away, and he then started to feel very, very ill. And 4 days later, despite going to hospital, no one could save him, and he died. And the Bulgarian Secret Service had injected a ball bearing into his leg, and inside that ball bearing was about 200 micrograms of ricin, easily enough to kill him. So if James Bond is short of ideas, plants can come to the rescue. So seeds can be surprisingly dangerous. So you might think this is jewellery, but actually, it's in case my negotiations with the Vice Chancellor go badly with my next pay rise. And we're going to see now a movie which shows you just how dangerous and unpleasant some seeds can be. And this is a film from the Christmas lectures, which I thought it would be fun to show you. So here we go. This chili comes... There's something wrong with me, I think. I could watch that all day. But the point of that video, apart from watching poor old Adam struggle, is that it shows you just how carefully targeted plant weapons are. And here's another example of that effect. This is a nettle sting, and we all know what an unpleasant experience that is. When we walk in a patch of nettles, the tip breaks off, and the nettle injects us with chemicals. One of those is histamine, which causes the same sort of effects, allergic reactions as we get when we have hay fever or something like that. And the other, one of the others is acetylcholine, which is a signal that we use in our nervous systems, and that tells us that we're feeling pain and discomfort. And the interesting thing about this is that, of course, nettles don't have nervous systems or immune systems, so they don't need those chemicals at all. They make them specifically to make our lives a misery. And that's how mean plants can be. But to really get to grips with the 300 million year war, we need to look at a particular case study. So I'm going to focus for the rest of the talk on the battle between grasses and grazers. Very important. Where would wildlife documentaries be without herds of wildebeest going across the Serengeti? But of course, we all know that our favourite bit is when they have to cross the river. It's that crocodile roulette that's quite entertaining, isn't it? But actually, as well as battling with the crocodiles, the wildebeest in their migration have to battle with grasses. Now, grasses are not just important to wildebeest, they're very important to us. All our main crops are grasses: rice, barley, wheat, maize. In fact, half of our food production is three crops: rice, wheat, and maize. And half the world depends on rice, one plant, for its staple food. And all those plants are grasses. So surely grasses haven't got any defences at all. They seem to be food for almost everything, including us. They do have some rather odd effects, though. Eating grass seems to have given the sheep two heads for some reason. But grasses, of course, food for cute herbivores like this vole, not so cute herbivores like these armyworms, and really rather stupid herbivores like sheep, although they are more intelligent than they look. Well, that's not hard, is it? And I'm going to focus on voles, because they're the cutest, obviously. Now, despite apparently being defenceless and eaten by all these herbivores, grasses are very, very successful plants. Grasses cover 1/5 of the Earth's surface. Well, what's the secret of this success? Well, one is that they grow from meristems near the ground. So when they get damaged, they can grow back very rapidly. So grasses can grow their way out of trouble. But there's something else they can do. they actually have a secret weapon. And grasses contain something called silica. Now, silicon, the element, is one of the most common in the Earth's crust, and plants can take that up in a soluble form through their roots. And they deposit it in their leaves in little granules known as phytoliths. And these can be up to 10% of the plant's dry weight. Now, some of these granules look sort of round and knobbly, but others look like little mini razor blades. So you can imagine eating that isn't all that comfortable. And these phytoliths are very, very hard. And each grass species has characteristic size and shape of them. They're like pollen grains. Now, what do these granules do? Well, one thing they do is wear down teeth. And you can see that if you look what happens to insect jaws. Now, mercifully, this isn't life size, but these are the jaws of a caterpillar. And this section here with these ridges is the cutting edge of their heads. Now, caterpillars have enormous heads, not, you won't be surprised to learn, because they have enormous brains, but because they need huge muscles to move these jaws through the grasses. Now, if we feed the caterpillars on plants containing a lot of silica, and then we chop their heads off, which doesn't do a lot for them, as you can imagine, and then we look at their jaws under the microscope, you can see that the edge here is much, much smaller than here. And in feeding on high silica plants in just a few days, their jaws have been worn right down. And this really reduces their feeding efficiency. You can imagine trying to eat with no teeth, it's pretty hard. And silica is very abrasive, so it wears down teeth. And it's a bit like when you go to the beach and your mum makes you some crab paste sandwiches or something else equally disgusting, and you manage to get some sand in it. And then you bite down and that crunchy feeling, that is exactly what silica does. And the more silica that a plant has, the more abrasive, the more able to wear down things it is. So you can see plants that have a lot of silica are very abrasive. And herbivores don't particularly like this. And this abrasion means that they don't feed as efficiently, but silica does something else. What it does is prevent them absorbing nutrients from their food. They can't absorb as much nitrogen from grasses when grasses contain a lot of silica. And nitrogen is very limiting for herbivores, and that means that they lose weight. So here's our lovely cute voles, and they were fed some grasses high in silica, and we left them to see how quickly they could put on weight. And when those grasses contained not very much silica, they gained some weight. But when the grass was high in silica, they started to lose weight. They got rather thin. It's a sort of silica as a size zero diet thing. It could be a hit. But there's something else interesting about silica, and that is that grasses respond to being eaten by producing more of it. But there's something quite interesting about that response. If we damage grasses and measure how quickly and how much they increase the amount of silica in their leaves, we notice two things. Firstly, when we damage the plants with a pair of scissors, the plant doesn't respond very much. When we damage it with a real herbivore, there's a much bigger increase in silica. And the plant can detect whether it's being damaged by a pair of scissors or by a real animal from signals it can pick up in the saliva of the voles. There's something else that's interesting about this response, and that is that it takes a while to happen. If you just damage a plant once, there's very little change in silica levels. The plant taking up silica is an energetically expensive thing to do, and the plant waits until it's been damaged several times before it starts to increase silica levels. Okay, so why does this matter? Well, good question. But this is actually a very important interaction. the interaction between voles and their food plant. Because voles are one of many animals that show very profound and regular changes in their abundance. So this is the number of voles over a period of time, and you can see that numbers increase very dramatically and then fall very dramatically, and this happens repeatedly. And these population cycles are quite common in animal populations. Around a third of animals show these sorts of population fluctuations. And for many years, ecologists thought that this was down to predators. For 80 years, we've wanted to know why this happens. And predators are believed to increase as the voles increase, eat lots of voles, drive the population down, then the predators also fall, so the voles increase. So there's a sort of pattern of cycles between the prey, the voles, and the predator. But actually, if you remove the predators, you still see cycles. So something else must be happening. And could it be down to the plant? Could it be down to changes in silica? Now, to understand how this might work, we have to know a little bit more about voles. And one thing you have to know is that voles have a very tight relationship between their body weight and their breeding. So the fatter a vole is at the end of the year, the earlier they breed the next year, the more babies they have each time, how cute are these, and the more litters they can have in a year. So there's a very tight relationship between female body weight and reproductive output. I don't know if the same is true in people, probably not really. So silica, you remember, reduces vole body weight. So our idea is that when the voles are feeding on high silica plants, their body weight drops, and that means they can't reproduce as quickly, and that could be affecting their populations. So how might this work? We can start with a high population density of voles, so we're at a peak in our cycle. That means that there's a lot of grazing on the grasses, and remember that repeated grazing led to increased silica. That, you remember, led to reduced growth rates and reduced numbers of babies. So we end up with low population density. What happens next? Oops, we go backwards. What happens next is that the grasses start to be damaged less, so they relax their defences. They don't take up as much silica, it's an expensive thing to do, and we know that when you stop damaging plants, over a number of months, the amount of silica goes down. So that way, oops, I keep going backwards here, we can get increased growth rates and go round again. So it's possible that changes in silica can drive changes in vole body weight, vole reproduction, and cycles. Now, you're probably thinking that's not all that convincing. And of course, although we've shown that this happens and this happens and this happens, we've shown all that under laboratory conditions. So what happens in the field, out there in the real world? Well, we've been looking. We've been out in Kielder Forest in Northumberland, where there are lots of different vole populations. The forest has these clear-felled areas full of grass. They're just perfect for voles. And there are lots of different vole populations. And if we go and look around Kielder Forest and collect grasses and measure silicon, and then we look at how many voles are in that area the next year, we find there's a negative relationship. So in areas where there's a lot of silica, then we find that the number of voles goes down. So where we have low silica, we have lots and lots of voles. So there seems to be the sort of negative relationship that we're looking for. But that's a correlation. how do we know the actual mechanism happens? Well, we need to do some experiments, some large-scale field manipulations. So we went to Kielder Forest in the winter, because it's more fun digging trenches and fences in snow, and built all these enclosures over a very large area. There are 90 of these cells. It took an age to build it all. This is the team. This person has left and got another job. This person has left and got another job. This person's in hospital having operations on their knees. This person's in hospital having operations on their back. This person decided to become a theoretician. And I'm still left because I haven't done any of the work, so I'm the only one still smiling. So setting this up was pretty difficult. But the point is that now we can set up different vole densities and look what happens to the silica. So that's what we did. Here's me doing the only bit of work on the entire project, putting a vole in a bucket. It was tough. And these are the different damage treatments. And you can see the more voles we put in the cells, the more silica we get. So we've created a situation where this is equivalent to a low vole population. The grass is not getting very damaged and isn't inducing a lot of silica. This is a situation where we're at a peak, there are lots of voles, the grasses are inducing lots of silica. And now we're going to put female voles back into these cells and see what effect the silica has on the grasses, on the vole reproduction. Okay, and one last piece of evidence just to convince you. When we go to different places in Kielder, we can find populations that are in a different stage. So this population here is just starting to increase. This population here is rising fast. This population is beginning to decline. And this population is in a trough. Now, we would then expect the silica levels to be very different in these different populations. If silica is what's driving these populations, then we should see very different silica levels here where the voles are increasing compared to where they're decreasing. And that's exactly what we do see. The silica levels are very high in populations that are in a decline phase, but lower where the populations are recovering and starting to increase. So we're very impressed with all this evidence, mostly because it's been so difficult to collect. But I hope you can see that a lot of the pieces of our hypothesis are beginning to be backed up by evidence in real populations, in real field situations over very large spatial scales. So you might think, well, it's curtains for voles. How can they fight back against silica? Well, herbivores have some weapons of their own. And voles have continually growing teeth. So the effect of silica on the vole's teeth can be mitigated by the fact that they grow them all the time. And I've got some teeth here. Now, this isn't a vole's tooth, as you can imagine. This is actually a mammoth tooth. I know it's very big, but no, really, it is actually the tooth of a mammoth. And you're probably thinking, well, it's huge, and mammoths were huge, so no surprise there then. But somewhere I've got another tooth. This is the tooth of a mastodon. Now, that's an animal that was the same size, but has very, very different teeth. And the reason is that one of these animals ate abrasive grasses and one of them ate soft leaves. It won't surprise you to learn that it's the mammoth that ate the grasses, and that's why they have this ridged area, and the mastodon eats soft leaves. I'll put these down before I drop them. They're fairly heavy. So you are what you eat. And this shows us that the 300 million year war is all about attack and counterattack. So about 25 million years ago, the climate warmed, so woodlands became changed into grasslands. Grasses became more dominant. And This is a fossil horse, not looking too cheerful. And at this stage, horses were browsers. And you can see their teeth were very small and could cope with soft leaves. But when modern horses arrived, grazers, their teeth were much, much bigger. And this increase in the size of the teeth allows them to cope with the abrasion caused by silica in grasses. So that's why this horse is looking a lot more cheerful than this one. So the 300 million year war has a real impact. Plant defences are very important, even in plants like grasses that we might think of as defenceless. And plants, they make plants look the way they do, and animals look the way they do. The war is driving the adaptations that organisms have. And we now think that defences can even drive the abundance of animals. Okay, I just want to, in the last few minutes, think about the war in the future. Well, one thing that those of us studying voles have noticed is that vole cycles are changing. They're becoming less pronounced. You particularly see this at high latitudes, like in Sweden. So the cycles are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. Why is this? Is it something climatic? Is it something about climate change? Climate change is going to have a big impact on grasses, like all plants. This is the food production, likely under climate change. And you can see the red and orange colours are where areas where production is likely to fall, and the blue is areas where production is likely to rise under climate change predictions. You can see there's only one country where things are going to get better, the Midwest of the US. There's no justice. And this has led John Beddington, our chief scientist, to comment that the agriculture industry needs to double its food production whilst using less water and less energy. And I just want to read you another comment. The world is consistently failing to produce as much grain as it uses. Aquatic food systems are collapsing, and terrestrial food systems are under tremendous strain. That's an upbeat assessment from the US Department of Agriculture. And we do have to do something to help our crops. What can we do? Well, it won't surprise you to learn that the answer, as indeed the answer to most questions in this talk, is silica. And we know now how silica enters plants. And for rice, which accumulates more silica than virtually any other plant, we know the gene responsible for this transport. And we know exactly how to change the uptake of silica by plants. And this is very important work from Japan. And they've created there, this is the wild type of rice, and this is a mutant which has had its silica gene turned off. And when that happens, it gets very badly damaged by pests, and the yield is much, much lower than with the wild type. Now, here they've been taking the silica gene out, but there's absolutely no reason why they can't put it in to other plants to enable them to take up more silica, defend themselves more against herbivores, and deal with other stresses. So we're going to have to use these sorts of creative ways to improve our food production in the future. So I hope I've been able to convince you that the 300 million year war is a very important driver for the way the world looks today. Most of the world's species are plants, herbivores, and the enemies of herbivores. So if we understand the interactions between those organisms, we understand a lot about the world around us. Plants are essential for all life on Earth. I've already shown you lots of examples of how they're important for medicines and for food, of course. So there's no more important topic to study, I don't think, than this battle between plants and animals as we face the problems we do face today: food shortages, climate change, and the loss of biodiversity. But we don't need to get too depressed, because drinks and canapés are coming up soon. Thank you very much.